We're ready to begin our study of Hebrews chapter 9, as we completed our study of chapter 8 last week. We're going to have a lot more about the particulars of the physical tabernacle, you can say slash temple in a sense, is the same pattern was followed for the temple as the tabernacle, as we also saw when we were studying chapter 8, but he's going to speak about those things some more in chapter 9, delving into the shadows that were there of that physical tabernacle and its parts, the things that it foreshadowed as some of those things, looking forward to what was going to be signified by Christ, some of that also what was not possible at that time, signifying at the same time about what would be possible and accomplished through Christ. And so that's going to be the primary focus of chapter 9 here in Hebrews. So let's get started by reading verses 1 through 5. We'll ask Brother, say Brother Caleb, can you read that? Hebrews chapter 9, 1 through 5.
They were in the first covenant are also ordinances of divine service, the only sanctuary. For there was a tabernacle, the first wherein was the candlestick and the table and the shewbread, which is called the sanctuary. And after the second veil, the tabernacle, which is called the Holy Temple, which had the wooden censer and the part of the covenant, overlaid around of gold with gold. Wherein was the golden pot that had manna and Aaron's rod that budded and the tables of the covenant. And over in the chimney of glory shining in the busy sea, of which we cannot now speak.
Okay, so in verse 1 he speaks about the that first covenant, which he closed chapter 8 by speaking about the fact that that was ready to vanish away, because that new covenant, which was a better covenant based on better promises, had been established, so that old covenant was decaying and it had was waxing old and ready to vanish away. So last week we noted the with the language there and the fact that the old covenant had been taken out of the way, nailed to Christ, to the cross of Christ, Colossians 2:14. So as a religious law, that had already been taken out of the way, and it was not going to serve as a religious law with authority in that respect anymore. That was done. It still had authority over the physical nation of Israel as their civil law for the duration of the nation, which was through 70 AD. So you had about a 40-year period of time, roughly, between Christ's crucifixion and the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, which ended the Jewish nation, that one of the Old Testament. And so for that period of time, the Jews, and not the Gentiles, but the Jews only, by the style of the way that the Romans ruled, they had the civil laws for the different nations that were in effect for them, and so that was the case for Israel. So they had to follow the law of Moses. The Jews did until their nation was finished. So that happened in 70 AD, and from that point, after that the old law, the law of Moses, has, as a law, does it have any authority for anyone today? And the answer is no. And the scriptures teach that and also teach us what will happen if we do submit ourselves to that law today. We would then be, and we've looked at Galatians 5, 1 through 4, that if we put ourselves under that law in any respect, one who does will be cut off from Christ. Christ will have no effect. and then we would be fallen from grace. He says all three of those things there in Galatians 5, 1 through 4, and also makes the point we can't just pick and choose from that old covenant. If somebody goes back and takes one part of it, as a lot of people do, and we referred to that last week also, that we will hear today even a lot of people that are in denominations will refer to or speak about following the Sabbath or observing the Sabbath, even when they're not just Seventh-day Adventists, but those who would recognize Sunday as the Lord's Day, they will refer to that many times as the Christian Sabbath. Is that found in the Bible? No. But the Sabbath was only part of the Old Testament law. That was not carried over to the New Testament at all. And also tithing. You'll hear people refer to giving their tithes. Well, is that included in the New Testament? Is that part of Christianity? No, it's not. Another one, of course, that we mentioned, instrumental music. That will be very often. That's one of the two main justifications that people will frequently or typically give for the use of mechanical instruments of music in worship today. Well, they did it in the Old Testament. What's the other main justification that you'll hear? What's that? Well, yeah, they will say that, but the two main arguments that will be used for using the instrument, they'll say, well, God didn't say we can't do it, and then, well, then they did it in the Old Testament. So that both of those are easily answered from Scripture. In fact, we've already seen it in Hebrews. We've already seen the answer to the, well, God didn't say we couldn't argument. What is the book of Hebrews taught about the meaning of God's silence from what we saw in chapter 1 and what we saw again in chapter 7. To which of the angels said he at any time, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee? Did God speak those words from Psalm 2 to any of the angels? No. He spoke those words to one being, his son, Jesus Christ. And so he used the argument there, to which of the angels did he say? What's the angel? Well, he didn't. So God was silent to the angels, and that silence meant what? Those angels are not God's son, and Christ is not an angel. So he uses that particular, makes that point of emphasis from God's silence, that when God is silent about something, that does not give authority. Because the angels couldn't say, well, we're God's son because God didn't say we're not. That's the basic argument that people use wrongly for a lot of things that they do that aren't authorized in the New Testament as part of their worship, such as using mechanical instruments. We also saw that in chapter 7 when he said about Christ not being a priest when he was on this earth, because in verses 13 and 14, Moses, that is God through Moses, spoke nothing about Judah being in the priesthood. So the fact that there was no spoken authority, that God was silent about that, meant it was restrictive and you couldn't do it. So we need God's spoken word to give authority for what we do and everything. So we've seen that argument answered in the book of Hebrews very well. So trying to argue about anything that, well, we're doing it because God didn't say we couldn't, that's a false argument. What is the right question to ask? Is the right question ever to say, well, where did God say we can't do this? That's approaching it completely from the wrong angle. If we have the right mind, that we love our Creator and we desire to please Him and live for Him who made us and owns us, then what are we going to ask? We're not going to say, well, where did God say that I couldn't do this? Because I'm going to do whatever I want to do unless God tells me I can. I mean, that's totally the wrong mind. That's not the humble mind of someone that is going to live for their Maker because they belong to their Maker. If we have the right mind, we're going to be asking the question, where does my God direct me or authorize, teach me to do this? And if He doesn't, then I'm not going to do it. I mean, that's the mind we've got to have, that we're going to only do what God has taught and authorized us to do in His Word. And anything that's in the Old Testament, only in the Old Testament, as far as a commandment or part of that law, is not for us to follow today in any way. Because if you take one part, if they're going to use mechanical instruments of music and use the Old Testament as justification for that, then what are they a debtor to do, according to Galatians 5:1-4? All of it, including animal sacrifices and all those other things that you don't ever see people do, but one is obligated to do. We also made the point, and it's going to come up here again. In fact, that last verse, verse 5, that Brother Caleb was just reading there, you see a problem with that very last phrase in verse 5, which we cannot now speak particularly. That was even true at the time of the writing of the book of Hebrews, and what's that in reference to? What did they no longer have where they couldn't speak particularly about that, even then? I mean, did they have the Ark of the Covenant anymore? They didn't have that anymore. That was gone. Those things that were originally that were in the place that God designated for it, like the Ark of the Covenant and the objects that were in that Ark, that's gone now. That was gone at this point. So those things could not be spoken particularly about, because there was nobody that was around in that time that had seen it for a long, long time. Now, if they were doing it right, the only person that could have seen it anyway would have been the high priest once a year. But at least that person could tell what it looked like to everybody else. But there wasn't anybody around to be able to tell them exactly what it looked like. But carried forward to now, there were things. The lack of the Ark of the Covenant, did that prohibit them from obeying any of the commandments of God during those years? No, it didn't. They still had the priesthood. They still had a high priest that could, with documentation, trace his descent from Aaron. But that ended in 70 AD. All those records were gone then. So this point of about, well, we can't speak particularly about that. Well, today, can anybody speak particularly about the origins, their genealogical origins, as far as what tribe or what family of Israel that they came from and descent from Abraham? No. Which would make it impossible to be able to follow the Old Covenant. If somebody desired and sought out that they were going to follow the law of Moses, and they were going to do it without any deviation, without breaking any of those commandments. Of course, they would, and then they'd be cursed. But even if they made that effort, there's no way it could be done, because they could never. There is no tabernacle or temple. There is no holy place or most holy place. There's no altar there. There are no priests. There's no high priest. None of those things. And there can't be. So following that law would make it somebody to be cursed, and that it's impossible to do it. And God obviously made it that way. He wasn't going to leave it so that covenant he was taking out of the way and removing its authority, where it would still be around and could be followed in every way. He made certain that it couldn't. So there's only one law, religious law, for man today, and that's the New Testament, the law of Christ. Which is the only one we are to follow. All right, well, he's going to continue here in chapter 9 in these verses of the reading. What was in the Old Covenant, though, and there's a reason why God gave that and then intended that it would wax old and vanish away when he sent his Son to establish that new and everlasting covenant, that better covenant that we read about in chapter 8. And he goes back to that and starts showing it. So in verse 1, he says, "Then verily, truly, the first covenant had also ordinances of divine service and a worldly sanctuary." Which means the new covenant has ordinances of divine service and a sanctuary, though not a worldly one. Which covenant had the worldly or physical sanctuary? That would be the law of Moses. This is going back to a point that we saw early in chapter 8. Remember chapter 8 and verse 2, when he was speaking about Christ and his high priesthood. Well, it's starting actually in verse 1. Actually, let's go ahead and read again from chapter 8, verses 1 through 3. Brother Ted, can you read that for us, please? So there he's making point about the first tabernacle that was there. That is that physical tabernacle, the one that Christ is high priest, and he's got, and we read in chapter 9, verse 1 about those ordinances of divine service. Well, Christ had somewhat to offer. He had to offer something. And so the Old Testament, the law with the tabernacle, that physical tabernacle and later temple that existed, and the priesthood and the high priest, all of that was designed as shadows for what was going to be established. Now, did he send Christ, make up the New Testament, and then have to squeeze things around to somehow make it fit into a fulfillment of whatever was in the Old Testament? And I don't know if I phrased that in a way that makes sense, but, well, the answer to the question I asked, at least as far as I understand it, would be no. No, he wasn't. He didn't have to get the New Testament, even though it came second, was the one that he had in mind from the beginning that was going to be the everlasting covenant. That was going to be established by his son. So when he designed the old covenant, even though it came first chronologically, it was specifically designed in with these commandments to be a shadow of what God was going to ultimately establish through his son. So, I mean, what did God have to have? Did there have to be a tabernacle in the Old Testament? There was a reason he did. There was a reason there was a tabernacle there. There was a reason that it was divided into two parts, a holy place and the most holy place. There was a reason that there were sacrifices, animal sacrifices that God commanded. There was a reason why there was a priesthood. There was a reason why there was a high priest and who had to bring in his offerings and all of those things, which he's speaking about specifically all of those matters here in this chapter and showing how and why God had designed it that way in the beginning of what it foreshadowed as far as the New Testament. That's the point here that we need to recognize. But again, this is something that he had already touched on back in chapter 8, even chapter 7 to a certain degree, when he was really showing how Christ's priesthood was after the order of Melchizedek and why it was a greater priesthood because of the shortcomings from what was in that old law. Well, we see that there in the beginning of chapter 8. So that high priest that we have, Jesus Christ, is a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. And he had his offerings to bring. Well, so in chapter 8 and verse 2, we read about the what was called the true tabernacle. And then we get to chapter 9 and verse 1, where he refers to the worldly sanctuary. Now, are those two things the same thing? No, this is the New Testament. This is the Old. So this worldly sanctuary, that physical one, that earthly tabernacle that was in the according to the law of Moses, that was a shadow of what Christ, that true tabernacle that the Lord pitched and not man. So he's going back, really building on where he started chapter 8 now, and is going to get into the particulars of that. So if we're going to understand, if we're going to understand the true tabernacle, and if we're going to understand what Christ, that offering that he made of himself, and his high priesthood, does it help to see the shadow that God established, the shadows that he established first, and then be able to see those particular points about how the express image or the real thing, what it is, that's why he's telling us about it. So verse 2, and when we read the word sanctuary there, what is that? Does anybody know what that word is, what it actually means? Now, this is another thing with language. You'll hear people that when denominations, they talk about their church building, what do they refer to the... What do we call this? Where are we right now? We call this, I mean, this whole thing is that we call it the church building. And we are in where? What do we say? Auditorium. That's what we use for it. Now, people that are in denominations, what would they call this? The sanctuary. Yes. And so with a denominational understanding, their understanding is the church is the building, really. And that the auditorium, as we call it, they call it the sanctuary. Well, is there something, what is the word sanctuary in the, if we're looking at the Bible word, what does that word mean? It's the sacred place. So that's what he's talking about, the sacred or holy place. So when he's talking about this worldly holy place, the one that was in, that's really a, speaking about the division or the designation for what was inside the tabernacle. And there actually were two sanctuaries, so to speak. There was the holy place and most holy place. And that's what he gets into right here in chapter 9. But so when people use the language and they refer to the auditorium of a church building, they call it a sanctuary. I mean, that's really, again, using Old Testament language in the designation of the for the tabernacle. I mean, this isn't the holy place. Is it? No. I mean, is the church the building? Do you remember that thing? Did you ever learn that little bit with your hands? It's like, you remember that, Jan? You know, hopefully our kids in here never learned it, and I probably shouldn't be talking about it because if they're ignorant of it, and Glenn's doing it. You know, we said, here's the church, here's the steeple, and open the doors and hear all the people. You know, you do that thing with your hands. But no, that's wrong, isn't it? Was there a point when you realized, you know, that thing I learned back, that was wrong. This isn't the church. And the people aren't inside the church. The people are the church. The ones who are in Christ. That's what the church is. It's not this building. This is not the sanctuary. Where's the actual sanctuary? Where is the holy place, the real holy place that was foreshadowed by that worldly sanctuary? And he's going to talk about the most holy place, that one that was in that physical tabernacle that only the high priest could go into. And this is the point he's going to be making in a few verses. It was a figure for that time present. It showed, it signified that the way in the most holy of all was not yet possible in that time. Who was the one and the only one, the high priest, who could go into the actual most holy place? And what is that place? That's heaven. And Christ could go there, enter in to heaven, having sacrificed himself, having accomplished all the will of the Father, and the Father raised him from the dead, and he ascended to heaven to be at the right hand of his Father in the most holy place, making it possible for us to ultimately go there for our eternity. Why would we think this is the holy place? Now, and is a physical location designated as holy by the teachings of the New Testament? who is supposed to be or what is supposed to be holy according to the New Testament. What does the word saints, what does that mean? The holy ones. I mean, that's who we're supposed to be. So we're supposed to be holy for I am holy. Actually, commanded that to the Israelites in the Old Testament. But we're commanded to be holy. We're the ones that are supposed to be set apart for God. Is there any physical location on this earth that is designated as holy? Now think about all the other religions that exist. And we know, what's the most squabbled and fought over place on earth? It's got to be Jerusalem. I mean, we know that there are three major religions in the broad sense that claim legitimacy or descent or connection in some way to what is taught in the Bible, going back to the beginning, to God's creation, and then Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and so forth. And we know that, yes, there are two true ones. There was the law of Moses, so the religion Judaism, Christianity, which supplanted that, and then, of course, the religion called Islam claims connection there, and they regard Abraham and the descent from themselves to be descended from Abraham, and so they had their holy sites. The Muslims do, and let's see, the Dome of the Rock, the mosque that's on top of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem right now. I forget what they claim happened there with Muhammad. That he was there, and I think that's where they claim that Muhammad ascended from the earth to heaven or something. Maybe double check me on that. That's not in the Bible, so I mean I'm not gonna. I'm not an expert on that, but something like that. I think that's what it was that they claim. But anyway, that's a very holy site to them, and they're violently protective of that place for that reason. Well, in the Jewish religion, was that site, the Temple Mount, what was on it, was that holy? Well, that's what that's the word here. That's what he's talking about. So all that remains there is that from the second temple is that part of that wall that's called the Wailing Wall now that's there. And that's a very holy site to Jews. But that's not designated by God for today, is it? Also in Jerusalem, you have certain sites, I mean, that many that claim to be Christians regard as being, I mean, they have the location over there in Jerusalem where that's supposed to be Christ's tomb, and I think it's an Orthodox church that's built over that site, isn't it? Jan, you've been there, I think, but and that's regarded as being a very holy site for Christians. Well, not, is that true of true Christians? Is there any earthly site that is holy to us? This was the whole point of John 4, when the Samaritan woman, when Jesus met her at Jacob's well, she asked a question. She said, our fathers say in this mountain, Samaria, that was the right place to worship. But you Jews say Jerusalem is the right place. So her question was, what is the correct or proper physical location on this earth where true worship is to be offered? What's the real holy place? What was Jesus' answer? He said the hour's coming where neither here nor in Jerusalem. And he was looking for when his covenant was in force, was it going to, whether it's Samaria or Jerusalem, were any of those places going to matter? No, what did he say? God is a spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. So it's not something physical, and it's not tied to a physical location. Is there any place on this earth that is designated by God for today that it is holy? Is there holy ground somewhere? No, there's not. And that's on purpose. There was then, but that was as a shadow. There was a physical holy place that was a shadow of the real holy place, which is heaven. And he's going to get into that a lot more through the rest of chapter 9 and on into chapter 10. So this is very important for us to recognize here from the outset. So this, the physical things that were of the old covenant foreshadowed that what was going to be established in the new. But today there is no earthly sanctuary, not in a building. It's not in Jerusalem. It's not any other place on this earth. That is against the very point of Christianity, where it's not the physical things that matter. It's what is spiritual. Alright, so as we look further here in chapter 9, so verse 1, it speaks of that worldly or earthly one, and there were ordinances of divine service in it, and so he's going to go into that some more in verse 2. So in verse 2, he says, there was a tabernacle made. That's where this worldly sanctuary was. And he says the first, and then he mentions the second in verse 3. So now he's talking about the way that tabernacle was designed. And it had two main parts, didn't it? Well, that's what he's speaking about there. There was a tabernacle made, he says, the first, wherein was the candlestick and the table and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. So that's the holy place. And then in verse 3, he says, after the second veil, the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all. So you had the holy place, and then you had what is the most holy place, or the holy of holies. Those were the two parts there. Now, when we also read about the organization of that area, outside of that, there was a court that came to be known as the court of the Jews. Outside of that, on the very outside of the compound, was what was called the court of the Gentiles. So they were on the very outside. But when you read about the court of the Gentiles, or where the Jews came as they were bringing their sacrifices to the temple, could any of the Jews other than the priests actually go into this building that he's referring to here? First the tabernacle, and then later the temple. Now, we went over that back in chapter 8. The tabernacle was the first building authorized by God. He made reference to that in chapter 8 and verse 5. That was made according to the pattern that was showed to Moses on the mount. And he quoted from the book of Exodus that described that. And then in the New Testament, later after... When did where was that tabernacle established? I know we're reviewing again. Where did the tabernacle, after it was first made? Well, the first 40 years of it, it was in a lot of places. They would have to pack it up and carry it to wherever God said to stop, where they would camp, and then they would set it up, and it would be in that location for however long that God designated they would be there, and then when he told them to move camp, they would pick up, and the tabernacle would be packed up again, and they would go to another place, set it up. But they did that. They wandered like that for 40 years. But it was not in a permanent place that God designated until they entered the land of Canaan. Up until then, throughout the law of Moses, the things that pertain to the feast days and the sacrifices that would be associated with or tied to that physical building, that worldly sanctuary, it wasn't, they weren't in Canaan yet. So how does he phrase it throughout the, when you read in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy? He will refer to it as in the place which the Lord your God will choose when you enter into the land of Canaan. That we'll see some form of that phrase many, many times in the law because it was before they got to Canaan. Well, it was after they conquered Canaan and they divided the land by lot, then God chose what place it would be. And it was not named ahead of time, but in Judges, it was. When they got there, what place did God choose to be that location for the tabernacle? Shiloh. And there it remained. It was set up there, and it remained there through the remainder of the history of the judges. Who was the last judge of Israel?
Samuel.
And when Samuel was a young man, when it was at the time when he was young and first called to be a prophet, it was, which was in 1 Samuel chapter 3, it's chapter 4, when Hophni and Phinehas were killed, those wicked sons of the high priest Eli, when they brought the Ark of the Covenant into their camp because they said the Ark was going to give them victory over the Philistines when God had delivered the Israelites into the Philistines' hands because they were wicked. And instead of repenting, they decided they would bring the Ark of the Covenant in. They said, it will deliver us. Well, it didn't, because there's no it there, it's God. And God did not deliver them because of their wickedness. So they needed to repent, but they didn't do that. So Hophni and Phinehas died that day, and they weren't the only ones, because the news got back to their father Eli, and he fell out of a chair and broke his neck, and he died. And then his daughter-in-law went into labor and died in childbirth. But on top of that, what happened to the Ark of the Covenant that day? It got taken by the Philistines, and then they took it off to their land. That was a horrible day in Israel that we read about in 1 Samuel 4. But he doesn't mention the tabernacle itself in that chapter, but he does in Psalms and Jeremiah mention the destruction of the tabernacle. We don't read about it anymore after that time. So, I mean, the tabernacle went down, and I mean, it was destroyed. And so there was no building in Israel until the temple was built. But as we also reviewed back in our study of chapter 8, that temple that God authorized, that was an idea that David had, but God gave approval to that, to build a temple, the pattern of that temple was given by God too. And then David gave that pattern to Solomon, who built the temple exactly according to the pattern that God had given. So what was true of the tabernacle that's mentioned in chapter 8 and verse 5, that it was built exactly, precisely according to the pattern that God gave to Moses, so it was for the temple later. So whether we're talking about the tabernacle or the temple, I mean, the same point applies, and it had the same setup. It had the same divisions with the holy place and the most holy place. So all these things that we're reading about here in Hebrews chapter 9, it applied to the actual tabernacle, which was a tent, but later to the temple as well. So no difference from that respect. That it was divided into those two parts, the holy place and the most holy place. What was in the holy place in verse 2?
It's the continual shepherd.
Yep. And who could go in there? The priests. Who were the priests? They had to be the descendants, the male descendants of Aaron. So any male descendant of Aaron was a priest and would have authority to go into that holy place where the table was, the showbread, the candlestick. And how often was the showbread changed? I mean, they went in there every day. The priest would go into that temple every day. So any priest and all priests, but only the priest, could go in there. We mentioned before one of the kings of Judah, that was Uzziah, Azariah, as he was also called. Uzziah went into the temple. He got full of himself, lifted up in pride. I'm the king. I can go wherever I want to and do whatever I want to. And he went into the into the holy place. He was of the tribe of Judah, which Moses spoke nothing concerning priesthood, and God only authorized it. He spoke nothing about anybody from Judah being a priest, and spoke nothing about anybody from Judah going into the tabernacle. But he did, and what happened to him? He got smitten with leprosy. That was the end of his reign as king, because he had to be in a leper's house after that. And that's when his son Jotham became ascended to the throne at that point. But there was no authority from anybody from any other tribe, or even with Levi, with the other families, other than the ones of Aaron. Now, I mean, we remember that issue coming up with some other Levites that had jealousy that their Levite brethren, Moses and his brother Aaron, that there were things reserved for them that they couldn't do. Yeah, number 16, with Korah. You take too much on yourselves, he said to Moses and Aaron. Korah was not one of Aaron's sons, so he couldn't be a priest. And Moses was the one that was designated as the judge for Israel, so he was the leader of the nation. And Aaron was the high priest. And those were two brothers. Well, Korah didn't like that. They didn't take too much on themselves. God is the one that... Did Korah believe that their authority was from God himself? No. Now, did he learn otherwise? The hard way, when he got swallowed up by the earth. And then what happened in the next chapter? And what happened in number 17? Where God proved to all Israel for all time that it was Aaron that God had authorized to be priest, Aaron and his descendants, his sons, and that nobody else could be. How did God prove that in number 17? What did he do? He got all the tribes to make a rod and have the name of the tribe on it, but for Levi, for that tribe, he had Aaron's name on it. And what did he do with Aaron's rod? It budded and bore almonds. What happened to the other rods of all the other tribes? Nothing. They stayed a rod. So what was the significance of that? God was making it clear by a miracle that he had ordained, that he had authorized for Aaron and his sons to be the priests in Israel, and nobody else could be. So what did he tell in number 17? What did he, at the end of that chapter, after that happened, what did he say to be done with that rod that he refers to here in this passage in Numbers 9? It was to be placed inside the Ark of the Covenant. There were three objects in that ark. That ark was in the most holy place, and there were three objects in it, which he's goes on and mentions in verse 4. But in that place, who could go in there? Only the high priest, and not whenever he wanted to. Only one day a year, on the Day of Atonement. He and only he could go in there on that day and only on that day. So there was one person authorized at one time in the year for one particular purpose carry forth and do the things that God commanded to be done on the Day of Atonement. So the rest of the other days of the year, the rest of the year, who went into this part of the tabernacle of the temple? Nobody that wanted to live. But the priests would go in daily into the holy place, that sanctuary, where the golden candlestick, showbread, and the table was. Alright, what separated those two parts? The veil. These things are all... I wish we had time where we could go back and read all the passages in the Old Testament about those things, but As he mentioned back in chapter 8, verse 5, all of this was according to the pattern that God gave to Moses. Well, I'm going to give you some references that you can look at, but much of this is in, particularly Exodus chapters 25 and 26 is where we find the details of most of the things that are being brought up here in chapter 9. I mean, Exodus chapter 25 gave the pattern by which the candlestick would be made and the table that he refers to there. And it's also in that chapter 25 of Exodus in verse 16 where he commanded that the stone tables, which was written the Ten Commandments, were to be placed in the Ark of the Covenant. And then Exodus chapter 26 describes the veil, and he had the pattern for the making of that veil to separate those two parts there. So those two chapters in Exodus have much of the details of these things that he's referring to there in Hebrews chapter 9. But as we saw there, I mean, this most holy place where only the high priest could go had the Ark of the Covenant in it, with the mercy seat, the cherubim. And then inside the Ark of the Covenant were those three objects. The tables of stone, the Ten Commandments. The original Ten Commandments. How many sets of Ten Commandments were there? Two. What happened to the very original set? Yeah, Moses broke one. As he came down to the mountain, his brother, Aaron, had made a golden calf at the behest of the people, and they were dancing and worshiping this golden calf there at the foot of the mountain. God told him they were doing that, and he came down and saw it, and then he broke the table. So then God brought it back up there and wrote on another set, and that's what went inside the Ark of the Covenant. So that was in there. And Aaron's rod, which is mentioned in number 17. And then Exodus 16. What happened in Exodus 16? What miracle did God begin there that became a miracle that occurred 6 days a week for basically 40 years? Manna falling from the sky to feed the people of Israel in the wilderness. And if you really think about that, I mean, those people had, they really did have a daily, even though the manna fell on 6 days, I mean, they got twice as much on Fridays to sustain them through the Sabbath. So they got 7 days of food in 6 days every week throughout all those 40 years they wandered in the wilderness. So how much did those people in the wilderness, the generation that came out of Egypt and their children, how many manifestations were there before their own eyes of God and His power? How many miracles did they see? And when we see that first generation that came out and how hard-hearted they were, they saw all that they saw. I mean, they saw the 10 plagues in Egypt. They saw even before that, they saw the three miraculous signs that Moses did in Exodus chapter 4 when he cast his rod upon the ground and it became a serpent, picked it up again, became a rod again. One, then number two, when he put his hand to his bosom and it took it out of his leprous, back in and out, and it was whole. And then number three, when he poured water on the ground, it became blood. So they saw those three miraculous signs in Exodus 4, by which they knew that God had spoken to Moses, and they bowed their heads in worship. Then they saw the 10 plagues, and then they saw the parting of the Red Sea, whereby God delivered them from the Egyptians and destroyed the Egyptians in the sea. Then they go in and they get water from the rocks, and then God, and that happened more than once, and then God is providing the manna every day. I mean, how many miracles did they see? And then these, for them to reject God and not to trust in Him to sustain them, to care for them, where they would believe in Him and obey Him, Well, I mean, there was a reason why God, where the Holy Spirit swore in His wrath they wouldn't enter His rest, and why they're given in Hebrews chapters 3 and 4 as the example not to follow, lest we don't enter into God's rest in eternity. So here in Hebrews 9, that pot of manna, which in Exodus 26, verses 31 through 35, He commanded them to take a pot of that manna and put it into the Ark of the Covenant. So you had those three objects, the Ten Commandments, pot of manna, and Aaron's rod. Now, in all those things, we have symbols of God's authority. I mean, from the very law that He gave them, from the miracle of Aaron's rod that showed that God had authorized for Aaron and his sons to be the priests in Israel. The pot of manna that showed that God, by His miraculous power, was the one that sustained them and cared for them. They had that evidence of God's witness. So, I mean, there was no accident that God said those objects were to be preserved inside the ark. Now, did that mean that everybody could, so that everybody could go by and see that whenever they wanted to? Who could actually see those objects in the ark when they were put in there? Well, whoever actually put them in there to start with, but then after that, did the high priest open up that ark and look in there on the Day of Atonement? No. What happened in 1 Samuel 6 when the people in Beth Shemesh, when the Ark of the Covenant returned from the land of the Philistines, and they looked in there? 52,000 of them died. God said, don't look in there. Don't touch it. What happened when Uzzah touched it when they were moving the ark to bring it to Jerusalem when David was king? And they didn't carry it the way God authorized, but instead had the oxen to carry it on a new cart. And so the oxen stumbled, the ark wobbled on the cart, and then Uzzah puts his hand up to steady it. But God had said, don't look in it, don't touch it, lest you die. He touched it, and what happened? So looking in that or touching it, that was an automatic death sentence. God said, don't do it. So those objects were placed in there, but it wasn't a tourist attraction. It wasn't something that people go and look at. That'd be a pretty... I don't think that many people would sign up for something. You can see something amazing. Now, you get struck dead when you do it, but if you really want to... No, that's not a... That wouldn't have been a wise choice. I don't think... What's that, Dave?
Ripley's.
Yeah. That's Ripley's the hard way. They were there. I mean, how would they know they were there? I mean, they had the scriptures. They knew the Ark of the Covenant was in there. And they knew what was in it based on what the scriptures had said. So that would... Give them the opportunity to recall all those things that had happened there. But God had chosen those objects to be placed in there for a particular reason. Those things now, I mean, the Ark of the Covenant was gone. Do we know exactly when the Ark of the Covenant disappeared or what happened to it? Probably. I mean, it disappears from history. It coincides with when we no longer read about it. We don't read about it after the building of the second temple. So at some point in that first temple, it's likely it would have been at the time when that temple was destroyed when Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, took it, but we don't have any specific mention of the exact end of the Ark of the Covenant. But after that point, after Jerusalem and the temple, Solomon's temple, were destroyed, we don't read about the Ark of the Covenant anymore. So a second temple was built, but it had all the other parts and everything there, but not the Ark. But it still had all the other things and everything they needed to be able to obey all of God's commandments, but they did not have the Ark of the Covenant anymore. And but then in after verse 5, those things that were, there were certain things ordained that would be done in that tabernacle for particular reasons. So let's read 6 through 9. We won't be able to cover everything that's in these verses, but he's going to build on what he's reminded us of that physical, that worldly sanctuary, and the parts of it, and the objects that were in there, all of that, what it exactly was for, what it foreshadowed. Let's read 6 through 9 for the date.
Now, when these things were thus ordained, always in the first tabernacle, accomplishing the service of God. But into the second, that the high priest, alone with once every year, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the errors of the people. The Holy Ghost is signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, or as the first tabernacle was yet standing, which was a figure for the time of the present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices that could not make him that did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience.
So that really gets to the bottom line. That actually goes back to points that were established in chapter 7 about the high priesthood and the law of Moses, and that the high priesthood under it. So we might remember back in chapter 7 about the Levitical priesthood in verse 11. What did he say about that priesthood? Why there was a need for a priesthood after the order of Melchizedek and one to be high priest, that is Jesus Christ. Yeah. I mean, could perfection be attained by the Levitical priesthood? Were there anything that those priests could do that could, by their actions, that could perfect the Israelites spiritually? No. And the law that priesthood was a part of, the law itself, verse 19 of chapter 7, made nothing perfect. So, and that's why in chapter 8, he said there was a need for a better covenant based on better promises that would be able to do that. So there is a high priest with a law, the new covenant, high priest being Christ, who's the very design of it is to be able to do that for those under that covenant. So that's the purpose of God for all Christians, all of the disciples of God's Son, Jesus Christ, that we would all be perfect as our Master, conformed to His image. That is the very purpose of that. So, but the Old Covenant and the Levitical priesthood could not do that. Well, that was foreshadowed by this, the way the building was designed, with a holy place and a most holy place, and a most holy place that the high priest and he alone could go to, bringing sacrifices every year for the sins. It signified that the way in the most holy of all was not yet revealed. So it was highlighting that shortcoming, and every single year it did that, until Christ fulfilled it, and then he established his law, and then, of course, he became high priest and entered into the most holy place himself, offering himself. And that's what the rest of chapter 9 is going to keep building on. So we'll pick it up from there, Lord willing, next time. But appreciate everybody being here this evening.